it's Friday the 11th of September. I'm John Dennis. Today, 8 years since 9/11, and in the week that three Islamist extremists were convicted for planning a major terrorist attack, we look at the continuing influence of Al-Qaeda. Joining me in the pod is our Middle East editor Ian Black and Guardian columnist Madeleine Bunting. We'll ask whether Barack Obama's making the world a safer place. Not everyone thinks so.
Some of the current administration's policies, I think, are jeopardizing our security unnecessarily.
We'll look at the bravery of British troops in Afghanistan. And we'll celebrate British folk music and the 70th birthday of the UK's oldest independent record company, Topic Records, with the label's boss Tony Engel and singer June Table. But first, here's Bill Overton with today's news.
The businessmen who ran the Rover car company made themselves rich while the company collapsed, according to a report being published today. The Sirius Fraud Office decided it wouldn't prosecute the so-called Phoenix Four, but it is publishing the investigation into how the company was run. It says the four businessmen who took over the company for just £10 paid themselves £42 million in pay and pensions, while 6,000 workers lost their jobs. Al-Qaeda is finding it difficult to attract recruits or carry out operations, Western counterterrorism specialists have told The Guardian. They say attacks on the leadership's stronghold in the Afghan border area of Pakistan has put them under heavy pressure. They're increasingly dependent on affiliates in Yemen and North Africa, but don't have much control. Union leaders are meeting the Prime Minister at Chequers today before the annual TUC conference. They'll tell him he mustn't make rash cuts in public services. The leader of the biggest union affiliated to the Labour Party, Derek Simpson of Unite, told us Gordon Brown needs to throw caution to the wind or Labour's certain to lose the election. Parents who regularly drive other children to clubs, sport or school will have to go through criminal record checks, according to the Home Office. Under the new rules being brought in to protect children from paedophiles, they could otherwise face a heavy fine of up to £5,000. Parents who take in foreign exchange students will also need to go through the checks. That's the story on the front page of the Daily Mail this morning, which believes it means one in four Britons will now be vetted for the new child database. Its headline reads, "Now Big Brother targets helpful parents." The story is also in the Telegraph, but the paper leads with its exclusive about assisted suicide for terminally ill patients. It says Lord Phillips, Britain's most senior judge, admits he has sympathy for assisted suicides. Our paper has the Al-Qaeda story on the front page, but we lead with an interview with the Financial Secretary, Stephen Timms. He's been trying to find out what he calls a smarter way of bringing children out of poverty, accepting Labour have failed to reach their target of halving the number. His solution is that in poor families, both parents should work. In the red top, sport hits the front pages, and of course it's football after England got through to the World Cup final next year with two games still to play. The successful manager Fabio Capello has been setting out his rules for how he'll run things there. First things first, Fab caps sex ban on wags. According to The Sun, Capello wants his players to leave their wives and girlfriends at home so they can focus. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Today, it's 8 years since the 9/11 terror attacks on America. Here in Britain, three men are awaiting sentence for plotting to blow up seven transatlantic passenger jets. 1,500 people would have died in the biggest terrorist attack since 9/11. So, how much of a threat does Al-Qaeda present in 2009? The Guardian's been trying to establish how much influence and power it still wields. Ian Black, Middle East editor, hello.
Hi.
And Madeleine Bunting, Guardian columnist.
Hello.
Ian, the Guardian's been looking at the state of Al-Qaeda 8 years after 9/11. What have we discovered?
Things are looking not great for Al-Qaeda, I think we could report. At their centre, somewhere in the tribal areas of Pakistan, the border with Afghanistan, there's a group of up to a couple of hundred people who still run this organisation. The picture that emerges is of an organisation that is under serious military pressure. Significant numbers of its senior leaders have been killed, particularly by drone strikes carried out by the CIA. They're having difficulty getting recruits. They're having difficulty organising terrorist attacks, certainly across the world, from this increasingly besieged headquarters. There is a sense, however, that some people motivated by Al-Qaeda's ideology are becoming active elsewhere. So you've got to look actually globally to see the kind of things that are happening. Some of the focal points are Yemen next to Saudi Arabia, North Africa, the Maghreb, the countries round Algeria. And then there's the question of, 8 years on, does the ideology of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, does it still motivate people? This week we've seen the conviction of three British people of Pakistani origin in a failed al-Qaeda plot. Since then, in Western countries, since the July the 7th bombings in London in 2005, there haven't been any attacks. So the overall picture is not great, but it's certainly still there.
Madeline, what's your impression of how much popular support al-Qaeda commands in Britain?
I think it would be a very brave commentator who would kind of put percentages on that. I mean, the vast majority of the British Muslim community, we know, is very opposed to the al-Qaeda ideology. What is kind of harder to identify is that the tiny minority who are signed up to al-Qaeda, between them and the vast majority, there's a sort of grey area where people are sympathetic. They might not actually want to get involved in murder or whatever, but there is a sympathy for a sense that al-Qaeda represents an ideology which tries to challenge the humiliation of Islam by the West's dominance politically, economically, strategically. So I think that the real kind of concern of this minority who are continue to be recruited, and I take Ian's point that they're not always successful, and intelligence services have been very good at kind of tracking them down and preventing things from happening that would have been horrific. But there still seem to be some level of recruitment. They're still signing up new people, albeit in small numbers. And they're still managing to generate a degree of sympathy amongst a section of alienated British Muslim community.
I mean, the successful conclusion this week, as you say, of this prosecution of these terrorist plotters. However, Ian, there were some loose ends in this plot, weren't there? Not least Rashid Rauf, the alleged mastermind of this plot, who's gone AWOL in Pakistan.
There's plenty of loose ends, and it's a very, very difficult issue. And I don't think anybody involved in this, whether it's, you know, where in any part of government, is going to be claiming that this is by any means over. I think, though, that people who look at the issue would, drawing back from immediate plots or criminal cases or individuals who might be motivated or recruited, whatever, in the larger picture, I think you see some interesting changes. Madeleine, of course, was quite right to talk about the reasons motivating a small minority of angry Muslims, mostly angry, disaffected young men, to take up arms, to wage jihad against the West. But the picture isn't static. And there have been a couple of quite significant changes in the last couple of years, and particularly over the last year. Essentially, the war in Iraq, which from 2003, after the American-led invasion, was a huge motivating factor. The West had invaded an Arab Muslim country. That was a very, very powerful magnet for people. It goes to the whole argument about the response to 9/11. Well, there was this terrible attack, and then George Bush, in his wisdom or unwisdom, more precisely, invaded an Arab and Muslim country and created a far larger pool of young, disaffected Muslims and Arabs who were prepared to act in violent ways against the West. Now, the war in Iraq is, in terms of the active participation, the British, the Americans, is now a different phase. It's coming to an end. The British have gone almost completely. The Americans have withdrawn from the front lines that they occupied for so long. And you see this reflected if you look at the discourse of al-Qaeda and radical Islamist groups. Iraq has become much less important. The focus now has shifted to Afghanistan. That's one big change. Another big change is that George Bush, mourned by not very many people anymore, has gone and has been replaced by Barack Obama, who, still in the early-ish days of his presidency, has got a lot of work to do, but has given out some very positive messages. The speech Barack Obama made in Cairo in June sent out a very, very different message to the Muslim world than anything that George Bush did. So the sort of anger and frustration that's been fueling this violent extremism has less to feed on, if you like. And I think this is a significant change. And there are other things that we can talk about in the course of the conversation that point to the battle of ideas. The extremists are very much on the defensive these days, I would argue.
It's Guardian Daily with me, John Dennis, and there's more in a moment from my guests Ian Black and Madeleine Bunting. And there's more on Al-Qaeda today at guardian.co.uk/terrorism. Also on The Guardian's website, Tom Phillips on the making of the film Birdwatchers. It's about the plight of indigenous Brazilian people. guardian.co.uk/film to find out about that. Tanya Gold visits the headquarters of Mills and Boone and learns how to write romantic fiction. guardian.co.uk/books. And Massive Attack are back, and they're being interviewed by Alexis Petridis at guardian.co.uk/music.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
What's that coming over the hill? It's Football Weekly Live, a special stream show beaming from near-Earth orbit into your computer at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 20th of September. Ooh. That day, of course, is the Manchester Derby and the Chelsea Spurs ding-dong affair. And as such, Football Weekly will be on hand to recycle other people's opinions as our own, even faster than usual, on all the day's big talking points. We'll have, as ever, a panel of top Guardian writers on hand. We'll have views from the grounds, and we'll have Sid Lowe phoning it in from Spain. You can chip in too, using the message boards or various other methods of communication, email, Twitter, or that SMS messaging business. That's Football Weekly, Sunday the 20th of September at 6 p.m. live. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, 8 years after the Al-Qaeda attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, is the world a safer place? In a moment, you'll hear what our guests think, columnists Madeleine Bunting and Ian Black on Middle East Editor. But first, The Guardian's Ed Pilkington put that question to the man who was governor of New York on the 11th of September 2001, George Pataki.
Well, for 8 years, we didn't have any more attacks. And if you look at the attacks on the World Trade Center, it wasn't isolated. We had had the World Trade Centers had been bombed and trying to bring them down back in 1993. And we had had attacks in our barracks in East Africa on the coal. We had been subject to periodic attacks, well-planned terrorist attacks against American civilians and, in the case of the coal, American military. And since that time, we did not face those attacks. Now, to say the world is a safe place today would be completely wrong. You know, there are enormous dangers. There are still those who, for whatever reason, hate the freedoms that we cherish so dearly in the United States and who want to attack us again, which is why I am concerned about some of the current administration's policies. I think are jeopardizing our security unnecessarily. I think it is a horrible decision to place CIA officials who were acting in the aftermath of the worst attacks against our country and against civilians, not our military, in our history, to place them in possible criminal jeopardy years after the fact is just, in my mind, not just wrong for those individuals, it sends the wrong message to all those who put their lives on the line to defend us. And I think it was a horrendous decision.
George Pataki talking to Ed Pilkington. Well, I'm with Ian Black and Madeleine Bunting. Madeleine, is the world a safer place now Barack Obama's in the White House?
Well, I think Ian rightly identifies that, you know, having a change like that in the White House has been hugely significant. I mean, Barack Obama has relatives that are Muslims, and he's been absolutely explicit and open and honest about his Islamic background. So, I mean, these are enormously important symbols, I think. Although I accept part of what Ian said, I think that Palestine continues to be a major kind of recruiting sergeant for an ideology which is that the West is intent on a policy of humiliation and exploitation of Islam. And there's enough kind of material and mileage in that kind of worldview to still radicalise young Muslims, whether it's in the Middle East or in the UK or in Pakistan. And Barack Obama, you know, people are watching closely. It's, in some senses, it's still early days. Within a few days of arriving in the White House, he had authorised the use of drones to bomb in Afghanistan. People have been thinking, you know, which way is this guy going to go? And Cairo was a tremendous breakthrough in a lot of ways. But people also are thinking, well, you know, he's still an American, and can he actually kind of shift a whole system, which has been, as Muslims would see it, very kind of contrary to their own interests and the advancement of sort of Islamism.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
I'm John Dennis, and this is a special end-of-the-week edition of Guardian Daily with our panellists, Middle East editor Ian Black and columnist Madeleine Bunting. In a moment, we'll talk about how the war in Afghanistan affects the spread of Islamist militancy in Britain. But first, the dire security situation inside Afghanistan was highlighted on Wednesday when the British journalist Stephen Farrell was dramatically rescued by the Parachute Regiment and the Royal Marines after being held by the Taliban. And the bravery of British troops was marked yesterday at a special ceremony, as Stephen Morris reports from Plymouth.
It wasn't a day for politics. Nobody was talking about the whys and wherefores of the conflict in Afghanistan. This was a day for celebrating great bravery and for remembering those who had not made it back. At Stonehouse Barracks in Plymouth, men and women were presented with gallantry awards. More than 100 were being announced, most of them for active service in Afghanistan. Afterwards, some of them talked about what they had been through. Men like Ben Kelly, who risked his own life to recover the body of a colleague.
I was pretty confident, well, I was very confident my company, very good operators, all of them, that 6th Platoon would do what they could to give me protection to allow me to do the job. 4th Platoon guys that were there with me at the time, I was confident they'd do their job to support me, so it allowed me to just concentrate on the job in hand, and, you know, it's a job that has to be done.
What's it like being in that situation for somebody who's never been in anything like that? What's it like?
I've been in situations like being shot at, IED, all the rest of the stuff. Training takes over. It's purely all about that. It's the training, the strong bonds you have with your guys, your mates, your muckers, that takes over straight away, and it's just, you've got a job to do. That's all the boys, is they look out for each other, and that's the thing that gets them through.
Stephen Morris reporting. Ian Black and Madeline Bunting are my guests in today's edition of Guardian Daily. Madeline, what about Afghanistan? How do British Muslims see the war in Afghanistan and Britain's involvement in the NATO war there?
Well, it's never been quite so clear-cut as Iraq. I mean, I think Iraq was seen as an absolutely unjustified act of aggression towards a Muslim country. Afghanistan, I think, has actually kind of led to a much more kind of complex sense because the Taliban... There are large parts of the British Muslim community that do not think the Taliban is a legitimate expression of their faith. The idea of hand chopping and terrible treatment of women. I mean, there are plenty of British Muslims that would just find that absolutely abhorrent. It's got no part in their faith. So they, I think, have felt very kind of caught. Afghanistan was in a terrible place in 2001, terrible high levels of hunger and so forth. So it's never had the same sort of radicalising impact on the British Muslim community. On the other hand, the conduct of the war, the way in which the level of civilian casualties continues to climb, all of this is deeply disturbing. And it means that young, impressionable kids who see so much kind of suffering in Palestine think, well, hang on, is there a pattern here? Afghanistan, Chechnya, Palestine. That's how they begin to link them up.
I agree that Afghanistan is complicated. It's not provided the same sort of focus and clarity as Iraq or indeed Palestine has for Muslims all over the world. The Taliban are clearly not a particularly attractive political movement, particularly if you take a progressive outlook on women's issues and human rights and so on and so forth. They are a dark and reactionary movement. It's quite hard to support. And also, in that sort of overlap, if you like, between the Arab and Muslim worlds, Iraq had a tremendous resonance. It was an Arab country, one of the core of the Arab world, the home once of medieval times, the glorious days of the Arabs, of the Caliphate. Afghanistan is a very different matter. It's a different culture, different languages, and it doesn't have the same appeal. Having said that, the American military action that kills innocent Afghan civilians at weddings and so on and so forth is clearly not going to endear anybody to American policy. Obama on Palestine, absolutely a core issue in the Arab and Muslim world. He hasn't achieved very much so far, but he's made a lot of the right noises so far. And the contrast, again, between him and George Bush couldn't be more striking.
And he has at least emphasised the importance of coming to some kind of resolution there.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's said more. He's gone further in terms of his intentions than any previous American president. Of course, the test will come. Will he be able to achieve anything? There are other issues, too. There's the very difficult issue looming for anybody concerned about world affairs and particularly the neuralgic issue of relations between the West and Islam of Iran, which, shows every sign after having, by all evidence, rigged its election in June, shows all signs of moving ahead to defy not only the West, but the United Nations over plans to develop nuclear weapons. That's another very, very difficult issue, another line of confrontation, if you like, between Yes, the West, but the wider international community and a significant part of the Muslim world, led by President Ahmadinejad in his second term. So that's another issue that is very much out there when we look at these relations and these sensitive areas.
A degree of hypocrisy in the West, though, Madeleine, about the support, the continued support for Hamid Karzai, whose re-election was really tainted in the eyes of many people. They condemn Ahmadinejad in the way that he was re-elected, but not Karzai.
I think the absolute kind of instinctive response of many Muslims, whether they're radicalised or not, is that the West operates double standards. This is nothing new. And backing Karzai, opposing Ahmadinejad, is just absolutely kind of yet another kind of example of the way in which Western foreign policy is morally bankrupt in the eyes of large sections of the British community. That is a different issue from radicalisation because, you know, you'll get a deeply committed British citizen who's absolutely signed up for, you know, his life here or her life here. But, you know, it's interesting how little faith they have in British foreign policy and in kind of sort of basic ethical standards that they believe should apply to foreign policy. And, you know, there's a very interesting gap there because it really disaffects young British Muslims. They're not going to, you know, throw bombs around about it necessarily. I'm not saying that's the link. But they do really have a kind of fundamental lack of respect for how politicians can allow Israel to continue to get away with breaking UN Security Council resolution after resolution. And yet when it's, you know, a Muslim country, you know, they'll invade if they break a UN resolution.
There are other issues as well. I think, you know, if you're concerned about double standards and hypocrisy, you have to look at Arab and Muslim countries, which, like Karzai in Afghanistan, are friends of the West, are clients, allies of the West, whatever you want to call it. Saudi Arabia, well, there aren't any elections ever of any kind. In Egypt, elections are routinely rigged by government. These are regimes which are considered stalwart friends of the West, and indeed have become even more so in the context of the fight against Al-Qaeda. Governments which have appalling records themselves have become extremely important in helping to struggle against bin Laden and his sort of ideology. One of the reasons the British government is now cozying up to the Libyans, after all, a country with which we had terrible relations over many years, is precisely because the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, is now our friend in terms of the fight against Islamist terrorism. So there are some strange alliances, some weird bedfellows in this particular juncture.
Ian, Madeleine, many thanks. In a moment, we'll change the subject completely with a look at topic records and British folk music. But if you want to comment on that discussion with Ian and Madeleine, do tell us what you think. Or if there's anything at all you'd like to say to us, you can leave a comment at guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily. You can email us at guardian.daily@guardian.co.uk or send us a tweet at twitter.com/guardiandaily. But now, a tune that's confounded many an aspiring guitarist, myself included. That's Davy Graham's original version of Angie. It was released by Topic, which this month celebrates its 70th year. It's the oldest independent record label in Britain, and possibly the world. Topic started in a basement as an offshoot of the British Marxist Party. Its roster of artists over the years reads like a who's who of British folk music. Ewan McColl, Eliza Carthy, Anne Briggs, The Watersons and Martin Simpson. The man who's run the label for 36 of its 70 years is Tony Engel.
We've been working with a field of music that has been fairly unpopular, to be realistic, for a long time. And that, in a way, provides its own protection. You develop systems to work under or over or behind the radar. It's just kind of, you know, survival instinct, I think.
Now, we've got on the line June Tabor, who's, one of the greatest singers ever recorded by anyone, let alone Topic. Once you'd started your singing career, how did you sort of make contact with Topic? Because you've had a long association with them now.
Oh, yes. Well, I bought a lot of their albums. This was how I learned about traditional music. The revival was going on around me, but traditional music was available astonishingly on vinyl, particularly the Kidman series of the folk sounds of Britain, recordings of traditional singers, which really captured my imagination. While I was, by this time, at Oxford University, we had a set of them in the Folk Song Society library, which was contained in a suitcase. This was just that we learned all these songs, we sang them. So Topic was just a name that was in, kind of engraved in my mind as being the record label for traditional music.
Tony, there's a strange sort of disconnect, though, isn't there? Because as June was saying, you know, a lot of people learn about traditional music through listening to records on Topic and other labels. But on the other hand, the act of recording something slightly sort of preserves it in aspic. And actually, the folk tradition is a kind of oral tradition, and one which, you know, has traditionally goes back much further, obviously, than the dawn of the recording age.
Yes, it's sometimes very uncomfortable, this, because the very records that inspired me, and indeed, from what June said, inspired her, we've got very parallel experiences here. On the one hand, they are providing that influence and that inspiration. But on the other hand, they're almost, by being recorded, they're contrary to the nature of the music making in the first place. But we're here now, we've got the records. If we didn't have them, we wouldn't have that music. So that's all really that matters to me in the end.
Topic has released countless field recordings of traditional singers. Can you explain what makes these different and why they're so important?
Well, most, we'll call them younger singers, and I definitely include June
thank you.
In that category, are performing in a different way than the traditional singers were. They're performing off stages, and they're making records. Traditional singers were producing a music which was purely for the community. They weren't actually trying to be stars. It wasn't part of their mindset. It wasn't part of their process to be massively successful. And I think this contributes to the nature of performance. They're not trying to seduce us in all the currently fashionable ways. And that's what excites me about it. I kind of liken it to hearing the voices of our tribal elders before our attitudes were so changed by the onslaught of continuous media.
And we've got a track, June, that we're going to hear a clip of, While Gamekeepers Lie Sleeping, which is included on this lavish box set, 3 Score and 10, to celebrate Topic's 70th anniversary. Can you tell us a bit, June, about this track?
I always dedicate this to my dog, actually. It's a poaching song. It's about a man who goes out at night hoping that he's going to catch something that his family will be able to eat. And he discovers to his joy that the gamekeepers are asleep. And so his dog catches a hare, and he takes it back to the pub, actually, and sells it instead of taking it home to be cooked. Then they both get drunk, which is, I think, wonderful. This is the epitome of a good relationship. You take your dog to the pub, he doesn't drink very much, and then he takes you home afterwards. Which is, it's all somewhere in the song, partly in my imagination, but it's a great gypsy song. I pick some rope and I smooth her down and I put her in my keeping. I says to me dog, it's time to be going while the gamekeepers lie asleeping. Away me and my dog did go back into the town. We took that hare to a labouring man and we sold it for a crown.
While Gamekeepers Lie Sleeping by June Tabor, and that's from the Topic box set 3 Score and 10, released on Monday. And the Topic 70 Festival begins tonight on the South Bank in London, where the Waterson family and the Eliza Carthy Band play the Royal Festival Hall. It closes with June Tabor in concert at the Queen Elizabeth Hall next Friday, the 18th. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Ian Chambers and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.